here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Thanks, of course, to Kipper the Cat. With Greg and Tony, they've just left the studio, but they got the evening moving right along as always. And now it's moved right along to us here at Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. And we're coming to you, of course, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. You can reach me at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk. And here's special greetings to Debbie and Audrey, who are listening in from deep in the heart of America. Now this evening, under lamplight, we continue our descent with Dante and Virgil, getting ever closer to the bottom of the pit of hell. Our stopping place this evening is the final bolgia, or ditch, of the eighth circle, the circle of basic fraud. It's a pretty awful place, but that's what we'd expect as we explore the depths of human iniquity and selfishness. But nevertheless, you are invited to attend. And what makes this final ditch so awful is that it is a place where unimaginably diseased bodies are just dumped and just lie there, sprawled one on top of another, many unable to move, some just crawling around, a few dashing around in complete raving madness. These are I falsador, the falsifiers, the ones who take the practice of fraud to its highest or lowest pitch, illustrating for us what I'm calling the disease of deceit. Deceit, conceit, related words, I suppose. You cannot practice deceit unless you have a pretty high opinion of yourself, full of conceit. And so if we begin with Bob Dylan's disease of conceit, we won't be too far off our subject of deceit. Nothing about it that's sweet, the disease of conceit. Or if you prefer, ain't nothing too discreet about the disease of conceit. Or again, they bury you from your head to your feet from the disease of conceit.
There's a whole lot of people suffering tonight from the disease of conceit. A whole lot of people struggling tonight from the disease of conceit. Come right down the highway, straight down the line. Rips into your senses, through your body and your mind. Nothing about it that's sweet, the disease of conceit. There's a whole lot of hearts breaking tonight from the disease of conceit. There's a whole lot of people just shaking tonight from the disease of conceit. Ain't no doubt about it, eats up your soul. Over your senses, you have no control. ain't nothing too discreet about the disease of conceit. There's a whole lot of people dying tonight from the disease of conceit. A whole lot of people crying tonight from the disease of conceit. Comes right out of nowhere, and you're down for the count. From the outside world, pressure will mount. Turn you into a piece of meat, the disease of conceit. Conceit is a disease that the doctors got no cure. They've done a lot of research on it, but what it is, they're still not sure. There's a whole lot of people in trouble tonight from the disease of conceit. A whole lot of people seeing double tonight from the disease of conceit. If your delusions are grander and an evil eye give you the idea that you're too good to die, then they bury you from your head down to your feet from the disease of conceit.
Bob Dylan's Disease of Conceit. Just to lead us more gently into the disease of deceit we'll be attending to this evening. You'll recall that we left Dante last time gazing down into the ditch containing the sowers of discord, all those people cut up, dismembered, slit, and gaping open. In particular, he was attending to the confessions of Bertrand de Bourne, that monstrous, decapitated figure who holds his head up high like a lantern so it can get closer to Dante up there as it speaks. And Bertram's words end the canto. Now, Dante is still staring down at these lacerated figures when Canto 29 begins. He's intoxicated by the sight of all this bloodshed, he tells us. Well, so many of us are like that, aren't we? Straining our necks to catch a glimpse of a gory scene. But in comes Virgil to bust up Dante's reverie. Che porguate, he scolds. What are you staring at? Are you planning on counting all the sinners one by one down here? Good luck. This circle is 22 miles around. You'll have a lot of counting to do. Then Virgil reminds Dante that it's getting late. They've been allocated only 24 hours for this journey to the center of hell, and their time is almost up. They have to get moving. Dante seems a little miffed. Virgil had always understood what was in Dante's mind before. Why has he misunderstood him now? As they move on, Dante explains that he wasn't wasting his time. He was looking for someone in particular, one of his blood relations. He's referring to Jerry Del Bello, a cousin of Dante's, always known as a troublemaker, a sower of discord, who was, in fact, murdered by a member of a rival family with whom Jerry had stirred up some sort of discord that hasn't come down to us. But, at least at the time our story takes place, no member of the Alighieri family had yet avenged Jerry's death. Perhaps Dante is looking for him to explain why he hadn't avenged the murder. Oh, you were looking for him, were you? Virgil says. Oh, sorry, you missed him. He came by while you were so intent on Bertrand de Bourne's speaking head. I saw him point to you and send up curses and threats your way. But we're past all that now. Attendi ad altro. Attend to other things coming up. And so they move on to the next pit. And let's promenade over there with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, Dante and Virgil leave the sowers of discord and come to the final ditch of this region of fraud. How does Dante describe what he encounters? Well, first, we get sight, or rather, the absence of sight, since at first it's too dark to see anything, but then, as they get to the top of the bridge, things become visible. And then there are sounds. Lamenti saetarum, lamentations like arrows, or as Dorothy Sayers has it, arrowy shrieks. Enough to move anyone to pity, but Dante now knows that these souls are no longer human, but merely emblems of sin, and so not deserving any pity. He presses his hands against his ears to stop those arrowy shrieks. Before we get the picture of these figures down below in the Valley of Disease, let's hear how Dorothy Sayers characterizes this region of falsifiers now rotting in disease. And this is, at one level, she tells us, the image of the corrupt heart, which acknowledges no obligation to keep faith with its fellow men. At another level, it is the image of a diseased society in the last stages of its mortal sickness and already necrosing. Every value it has is false. It alternates between a deadly lethargy and a raving insanity. These ditches began with the sale of the sexual relationship and went on to the sale of church and state. Now, the very money is itself corrupted, every affirmation has become perjury, and every identity a lie. No medium of exchange remains. No medium of exchange remains. And the general bond of love and nature's tie is utterly dissolved. Well, that's pretty dire. Are you ready to attend further to this material with us? Dorothy Sayers shows two levels of this corruption. First, there's the individual corrupt souls who have no connection to other people, who live entirely for themselves, keeping faith with no one. They care about others only insofar as they can use other people. And in fact, they care very little about themselves also, since they're willing to pervert themselves in any way they feel they need to in order to gain something from others. And Dante will metaphorically represent this state of the soul through various kinds of diseases, which we'll look further into in a moment. But then there's the second level of corruption. People like this spread their disease throughout the community. They corrupt the money, so we always have an element of distrust in any transaction we make. This is not just people who counterfeit the coin of the realm, but also those who hack into credit cards or our online banking accounts. You know how so much of our monetary exchange online these days is corrupted by doubts about the security of our information. We're so used to this distrust that we have forgotten how to take people on faith. Maybe all kinds of hackers fall into this category. We may say more about that later. And then there's perjury, where we can never trust anyone to be telling the truth, least of all the politicians who are supposed to be making policies that hold together our entire community. All this is gone when we come to the last of these three ditches, the last of these ditches of fraud.
There's a story going round, and it started long ago, and everyone keeps telling it in places high and low. And because my heart is weary, I really want to know, is it true what they say? Is it true? Is it true there is magic that we have never known? Is it true there are powers that we can call our own? Is it true there is someone whose wonders stand alone? Is it true what they say? Is it true? Not do you feel it grow? Now I see it with my eyes.
a little break with the Fraggles. A kind of rousing spiritual, holding on to good faith, I think, despite the doubts about whether anything we're told is ever true. And to continue these general remarks about the disease of deceit, here's what Robin Kirkpatrick has to say about this region. It's a place where, he says, mimicry, false coining, and misguided science interfere with the trustworthy relationship between humans and the world around them, substituting illusion and deceit for the truth-bearing realities of natural phenomena. Got that? It's good. Listen again. We lose the truth-bearing realities of natural phenomena. We don't trust the accuracy of a photograph since we know the deceit of photoshopping. Of course we don't trust those voices on the telephone who are only trying to help us with our computer problems or want to inform us about the great prizes we've just won. In fact, many people I know will no longer answer the phone unless it's a number that they already recognize. This means, for instance, that if I phone a close friend and the number comes up as unidentified, as it does when I phone, for instance, America, my friend won't answer. Well, that's not the end of the world, but it is a break in community. And then there's all the virtual reality substituting, as Robin Kirkpatrick says, substituting illusion and deceit for the truth-bearing realities of natural phenomena. We don't usually think of virtual reality as deceit or even fraud, but isn't that what it is? Cheating us or luring us away from the natural phenomena, the only real avenue to the truth of the world? Okay, enough of this heaviness. I'm calling for a break in the proceedings for some music. When we talk about the nightmare of our unreal world, we come close to one neighborhood of the Kinks Kingdom in the earlier 70s, and here is a triptych, three songs from the Kinks that describe the nightmare Dante presents to us in this part of his Inferno. The first song comes from the 1975 album Soap Opera, a narrative album about a boring bourgeois man, Norman, who, at least in his fantasies, impersonates a rock star who then decides to live like an ordinary man, like, for instance, Norman himself, in order to learn what life is like for ordinary people, all for art's sake. And, of course, there's Ray Davies, living in a bourgeois neighborhood but going to work as a rock star, drawing for material on his boyhood days with friends and family in North London. Who is who? Which is the real person? Norman, or the rock star taking the place of Norman, has just spent the day at the boring office answering phones and dictating letters, stuck in the office from 9 until 5, where life is so incredibly dull. After work, he goes to the pub to forget the tedium, and now we see him leaving the pub for home. Our hero leaves the pub, the preface to the song tells us. His head still swimming with alcohol, his head buzzing with facts, figures, and computers. Night is descending as he wearily makes his way home through the traffic jams and neon lights of the great metropolis. All he sees is imitation, he says, and it is a horrible nightmare. But, and here's the kink in the song, he turns it around and transforms the urban landscape into a perverse pastoral idyll. I've got imitation moonlight standing underneath the neon sign. If you can't get the real thing, then let's pretend the neon sign is the moon. Make friends with the falsity around us. Always possible when under the influence of too much alcohol. Electronic nature made by man with robots in mind. Big city lights guide my way into the night. Darkness shines when I'm standing underneath the neon sign. If there isn't any sunshine, we'll sunbathe by the neon sign. And if we can't see any stars at night, we'll sit and watch the traffic lights. Is it only an illusion? Have I been drinking too much wine? Can there be daytime when it's night underneath the neon sign? Is it Mother Nature playing tricks with my eyes? For darkness shines when I'm standing underneath the neon sign.
There's no earth beneath my feet. There are no trees or fields in front of me. Only slabs of concrete. Skyscrapers reaching up to the clouds. Don't give the moon a chance to shine. And I got imitation moonlight standing underneath the neon sign. Is it real or just illusion? Can there be daytime when it's night? Is it merely my delusion? Are my senses telling me lies? Is it just hallucination? Have I been drinking too much wine? I don't know if it's day or night. When I'm underneath the neon sign, underneath the neon sign. Electronic nature made by man with robots in mind. One big city lights got my way into the night, darkness shine. When I'm standing the neon sign. If there isn't any sunshine, we'll sunbathe by the neon sign. And if we can't see any stars at night, we'll sit and watch the traffic lights.
The Kinks, Underneath the Neon Sign, with an anti-pastoral, we might say. And next, we'll go back a few years to the 1972 album Everybody's in Showbiz for the much harsher Unreal Reality, a nightmare vision brought on by far too much cheap and exhausting touring from one gig to another and by the glitzy rock glamour of the early 70s. Ray was always sensitive to the phoniness of fashionable falsity. All around me is such unreality, optical illusions as far as my eyes can see. Is the whole thing a fake or the ultimate reality? Look at that lady. She got silver all over her face. Is she a human being or a creature from outer space? Is she authentic or phony? I guess it's just a matter of taste. See that fella, looking all spick and span. Is he a tailor's dummy or is he a real man? Is he genuine or straight off the assembly line? And like so many Kinks songs, this has roots in the sing-alongs, a community's song, though going wrong in several places. Attend also to the horns, to the horn backing, one of the features of the Kinks songs of this period.
All that I see.
The Kinks with the second of our triptych of songs, Unreal Reality, with the subtitle in parentheses, The Real Thing. And we move to 1974 for our third song, Scrap Heap City, from the album Preservation Part 2, another rock opera from this period. There's been a revolution. The sanctimonious left have toppled the corrupt right-wing tyrant, but instead of setting up the free society they'd promised, they just turn everything into a drab, monochromic world where there are none of the things that make community life possible. How can you have community when all the people look the same? There are no diseases here, as in Dante, just a kind of blankness where there are not even any animals left, except in the zoo. Not that anyone's going to the zoo anymore. Here are the Kinks in their imitation country style with Scrap Heap City. Scrap Heap City, closing out our triptych of three Kinks songs about substituting illusion and deceit for the truth-bearing realities of natural phenomena. You see, I can't get Robin Kirkpatrick's phrase out of my head. And I suppose I could add that here we are in your head as you are listening to Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105. We're attending to the region of Dante's Inferno containing the worst kinds of falsifiers. We've wandered around the subject so far, but now it's time to see further what Dante has to tell us. But first, this.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
Thank you. So, we've talked in general about corruption, the rottenness of fraud and falsification, but now it's up to Dante to give us imagery showing us what this state of the human soul is really like. Well, for one thing, Dante says, it was reminiscent of the plague that had afflicted the region of Aegina, as described in Ovid's Metamorphoses. we'll attend for a minute or two to the way Ovid describes this plague. But I have to warn you that it may be disturbing. In fact, it will be disturbing. That's its point. But look, we're attending to some of the best literature in the world, both Ovid's Metamorphoses and Dante's Divine Comedy. And how could they possibly qualify as great literature if they didn't include the horrors of human existence as well as everything else? And how could we be great readers if we too didn't attend to this side of life? So I warn you, but we'll be here together and see what these writers have to show us. So here's how Ovid describes this plague brought upon the innocent mortals of Aegina by the wrath of Juno, queen of the heavens. First of all, the animals started dying around the farms and the hillsides and all over. Their foul corpses, as Ovid says, and as usual, I'm using Melville's translation, their foul corpses lying where they fell, their stench tainting the air, decomposing and putrefying all around. Of course, that's the way plagues often start, and then they get to the human beings, and that's what happened. The doom weighed heavier as the plague attacked the wretched farm folk and gained mastery within the city's walls. The fever first inflamed the intestines. Symptoms were short breath and flushing skin. The tongue was furred and swollen. The mouth gaped open, parched by the hot wind, straining to gulp the suffocating air. Bedclothes and coverings of any kind were unendurable. Upon the ground they placed their bony bodies, but the earth gave no relief and gained their fevered heat. Unchecked and uncontrolled, the savage plague broke out among the doctors. Their own skill disqualified their owners. Why, the more closely and faithfully men served the sick, the rapider their road to doom. Whew. Well, then the panic in the population, who see no safety, and so they spend their final moments in lustful abandon, or crowding at fountains, wells, brooks, rivers, desperate for a few drops of water, or just mindlessly wandering in the streets, drifting half alive while they had strength to stand. There were people falling down in the streets, in their homes, in the temples, even as they were making offerings to try to placate the gods. In fact, when they would go up to the altar to sacrifice a bull to the gods, before the priest could even slit the beast's throat for the offering, the beast fell down dead from the plague itself. And this, Dante says, gives us an idea of the kind of rotten, disease-ridden bodies he saw in this final bulger. But we need a break here, don't we? Let's... ready, here it comes. Let's stay with gruesome diseases, but with a comic... Well, I suppose we can call it comic, with a comic touch. We'll listen in to the Firesign Theatre's famous or notorious quiz game called Beat the Reaper from the album Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him. Oh, yes, and it's also, I suppose, in pretty bad taste, but it's funny.
Oh. Hey, I think he's coming around.
He's coming around, folks. He's going to be okay and ready to play Symptom 6 of Beat the Reaper.
Last week, our patient successfully survived the common cold, measles, pneumonia, dengue fever, and the yaws.
And now, the big question. Are you ready to go on?
Where?
He's ready!
Now, our topless nurse, Judy, is wheeling our patient into the isolation ward.
Can you hear me in there? Okay, let's shoot him up. Now, patient, you have 10 seconds to tell us what you've got and beat the Reaper!
I'm shaking feverishly. My hands are all...
And now you've reached the final threshold. Here's the question. Are you ready for symptom number 7, longer than any patient has ever survived before?
I want to go home.
Only one way to do that. Doctor, bring in the super shot.
Now, for the first time on Beat the Reaper, we're going for the big disease. The icebox is being unlocked by the president of the Armenian Medical Association, under whose strict supervision these toxins are being administered.
This is it. Doctor, give him that really big disease. Now, patient, can you hear me? You've got 10 seconds to tell us what you've got. And for the last time, beat the Reaper!
I don't know, whatever it is, I want to die.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. That's not correct. You didn't beat the Reaper. Doctor, bring the patient out and show the amphitheater audience and all the folks at home just what he's contracted.
According to my careful prosthesis, this man has the plague.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome.
You've got the plague. Well, isn't he a good sport, folks? We'll be back in just a moment with our next patient, but first...
Yes, wasn't he a good sport? That was the Fire Sign Theatre, one of their best sketches, I think. What makes it work is the way the horror of deadly disease is coupled here with the pseudo-jolly television medium filled with falsifiers of all kinds, playing on even our basest desires in order to get audiences, but masquerading it all with that upbeat organ and droolingly cheerful announcer. And don't forget our topless nurse, Judy, for all the dads out there. Well, let's get down to the actual people Dante sees in this villager. Dante notices two bodies unable to sit up by themselves and propped up one against the other. They are afflicted with a kind of leprosy or some other horrible skin disease, and they spend all their energy trying to scrape off the scabs that cover them from head to foot. These two are Grifolino da Arezzo and Capocchio, known as alchemists, people who claimed to change base metals into gold. Does Dante believe that alchemists could really transmute metals? Well, the issue is not raised. The concern is with their intent and the way they defrauded the poor dupes who believed that they actually could produce gold for them. But these alchemists also stand for many others in our society. They may be taken to figure... Here's Dorothy Sayers again, so sharp about these things. They may be taken to figure every kind of deceiver who tampers with the basic commodities by which society lives. The adulterators of food and drugs, jerry builders, manufacturers of shoddy, and so forth. As well, of course, as the baseness of the individual self consenting to such dishonesty. We think immediately of genetic modification, especially where the labeling hides the ingredients, or people who build and give approval to, say, large high-rise buildings or flats, knowing that the fire hazards have not been adequately dealt with. Arthur Miller's play All My Sons deals with the same sort of thing. The manufacturer who knows that the parts he's produced are faulty, but in order not to lose money, he sends these parts anyway to build airplanes, which then malfunction in mid-air. Leprosy is Dante's image for all these. The very material of their bodies becomes shoddy and is eaten away, and they try fruitlessly to peel away the fake skin to reveal some sort of real skin below. But they have lost the ability ever to perceive real material anymore.
All that I see. Is it there?
Canto 29 closed with the episode of the leprous alchemists. All of a sudden, now at the beginning of Canto 30, due hombres morte nude, two pallid, naked shades rush up, snapping their jaws like pigs or boars rushing out of an open sty. One of them comes up to Capocchio, one of these alchemists we've just seen, and spears him in the neck with his tusk and drags him away, Capocchio's belly scraping along the ground as he's dragged away. Who are these two savage figures? Grifolino explains that the one who dragged away Capocchio is Gianni Schicchi, and the other is Mira. These two bestial souls represent the impersonators, the next form of falsifying represented here. Because they took on the appearance of someone else, then they have lost all semblance of their own form and come as rabid beasts, rabbiosi, frenzied. The technical term for their disease of rabies is hydrophobia in Greek, fear of water, since the disease is characterized by an aversion to water and a difficulty in swallowing. Gianni Schicchi was a renowned impersonator, but unlike all those entertainers we know today who amuse audiences by imitating celebrities, Gianni used his talent to defraud others, not to entertain them. One of his most notorious capers, alluded to here by Dante, was the time he impersonated Boisso Donati, who had just died. His son, Simone Donati, was afraid that Boisso's will had not left him anything. So before anyone else knew that Boisso had died, Simone hired Gianni to lie in bed, pretending to be the ailing Boisso, and to make a public announcement that he was leaving all his property to his son. The trick worked, and while he was at it, Gianni, in his guise as the dying Boisso, added a final wish to his oral testament. He says, And finally, I wish to leave to my dear friend Gianni Schicchi my prize mare, the Queen of Horses. And so Gianni got an extra reward for his fraud. The other figure, Mira, is a much more scandalous impersonator. Ovid tells her story. It's the kind of thing Ovid loved, a sexy love story with all sorts of complications. Mira was a princess who suddenly felt herself one day falling in love with her father, the king. Not really in love, she lusted after him. She resisted this feeling with all the virtuous strength she could muster, ashamed of herself for this unnatural desire for sex with her father, and then coming up with reasons to excuse this lust as well just the way things go, and then feeling repelled by herself, and then back and forth. She was miserable and finally decides to hang herself, but her nurse heard her and came in and asked her what was wrong, and finally got Mira to confess. She was at first horrified, but then offered to help Mira get into bed with her father. So the nurse tells the king that there's a beautiful young maiden who is madly in love with him, but she's terribly shy and can come to him only if it's completely dark and if they say no words. And so Mira comes into her father's bedroom in the dead of night, hesitant, afraid, ashamed, horrified by what she is about to do, but she does it. They come together every night for 9 nights, until at last the king's desire to see this girl leads him to light a lamp while she sleeps, and he sees that this is his daughter. He grabs his sword to kill her, but she wakes, runs out, and escapes from the palace and the kingdom. And here she is, in the ditch, devoted to impersonators. Souls now running around, mad with inhuman rabies. Do we also count among these souls those today who, with Botox and other kinds of cosmetic surgery, put on a false front to others, impersonating Barbie or Melania Trump or some other pseudo-glamorous icon? Do we want to speak about transvestites here? Yes, if their aim is to defraud others, though as we know, that's not always the motive. So now we move on back to Dante. We meet next the counterfeiters, in the figure of Maestro Adamo, Master Adam, afflicted with dropsy, so that his belly is woefully distended. He looks like a lute, that guitar-like instrument with a hemispherical soundbox. Il viso non risponde alla ventraia. His face and his belly do not match. The belly is so much larger than the face would suggest. Master Adam tells Dante that he had plenty of everything he ever wanted, but he went and forged coins to get even more money. And now here he is, having plenty of water in him, yet craving more, spending his whole time fantasizing about the water-filled rivers he remembers from his life on earth. All the rich people who have more than they need but still go in for all these fraudulent business deals or tax cuts, their souls are dropsical, craving more and more of what they already have in plenty. Well, next come the perjurers, those who have given false testimony. They are delirious with fever, steaming, immobile, putrid, giving off a rotten, disgusting stench. It's hard to get lower than this. And here we see Sinon, the Greek, who, in Virgil's account, was left behind with the Trojan horse when the Greeks pretended to sail back home in defeat. It was Sinon's task to give false testimony to the Trojans, telling them that this horse was an offering to them now that the Greeks had quit. And his story convinced the Trojans to bring the horse inside the gates of the city. You know the rest. In the middle of the night, while the Trojans were celebrating victory, the Greeks poured out of the hollow horse, opened the gates for the rest of the army, and burnt the city. And now Sinon lies like that ruined city, a rubbish heap of a human being. And here, too, is Potiphar's wife, the woman who tried to seduce Joseph in the book of Genesis. And when Joseph, righteous little prig, actually, when he refused to go to bed with her in a tactless way, which was his manner, she told her husband that Joseph had tried to seduce her, and for that, Joseph was thrown into prison. So there's all sorts of injustice here. Nothing to bind people together. And to illustrate this, Dante concludes the canto with a quarrel between Sinon and Master Adam, as they hurl insults and feebly try to strike out at each other. This is actually pretty fascinating. Something in us likes to see nasty people fighting among themselves. And Dante's fascinated too, and until Virgil says, "Sure, go on gaping at that quarrel, and I'll be quarreling with you in a minute." Dante immediately returns to his better self and feels intense shame, which softens Virgil as the two walk on to find out what's next. We too leave the quarrel and await what comes next. And what does come next? What is it that Dante tries to make out in the gloom up ahead? Another city with lofty towers? Or are these shapes actually huge giants? What's coming next? Let's not be melodramatic about it, but let's just say, what's coming next? Well, just wait till next time, and we'll see as we come closer and closer to the end of Dante's travels through the Inferno. We're now coming to Canto 31. There are 34 cantos in all, so you see, we're almost there. So come back next time and see what's before us, as we descend to the place where, actually, I'll give you a little hint, hell freezes over. Meanwhile, thank you for joining me here with Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, no defrauding impersonator here, and I wish you good night as we go out with just a little bit of this piece from John Philip Sousa, Mira Gavotte, a slow dance, but maybe it fits what we heard about the story of Mira. There's a kind of creepiness to it. So here it is, and good night till next time.